Our reading is from Paul's second epistle to the Corinthians, from chapter 4, verse 16, to chapter 5, verse 8. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary, but what is unseen is eternal. Now we know that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven, not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. Now it is God who has made us for this very purpose and has given us the Spirit as a deposit, guaranteeing what is to come. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord.
This is the last time we're going to be turning to the book of Ecclesiastes for a little while for our morning Bible study. Today we're looking at the second half of chapter 9 right through to the end of the book. Hope you've learned where to find Ecclesiastes by now. This is the fifth time you've had to find it, after the book of Proverbs, somewhere near the middle of your Bible. I want to read some verses that begin towards the end of our study passage this morning. In chapter 11, verse 7, through to chapter 12, verse 1. Ecclesiastes, chapter 11, verse 7, then. Light is sweet, and it pleases the eyes to see the sun. However many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless. Be happy, young man, while you are young, and let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see. But know that for all these things, God will bring you to judgment. So then, banish anxiety from your heart, and cast off the troubles of your body, for youth and vigor are meaningless. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, before the days of trouble come, and the years approach when you will say, I find no pleasure in them. There's a Polish proverb which says, think before you think. It's quite good advice, I think. For life is in many respects much easier if you don't think about it too much, isn't it? Just get up in the morning, go to work, come home, have a meal, watch TV, go to bed. So next day you can get up in the morning, go to work, come home, have a meal, watch TV, go to bed. There's a lot to be said for just mindlessly enjoying each moment as it comes in that way. You can sustain such a routine for years and years and be really quite acceptably happy with it. Millions of people do so. But it only works if you don't let yourself think. Once you start thinking, well, that's when the restlessness and the dissatisfaction and the anxiety start gnawing at your soul. Why am I here on this planet? Why are any of us here? Why, among the millions of lifeless and uninhabitable worlds that might have resulted from that Big Bang the scientists talk about, why did this world emerge? Why did human life begin? Why am I here? Yes, think before you think. But once you start that line of thinking, it's a dangerous enterprise. It ruthlessly exposes all those questions we can't answer, all those mysteries we can't unravel. And as a result, such thinking is very likely to lead you to feelings of frustration and exasperation you might well have avoided altogether if you'd been content to keep the gearbox of your mind disengaged. That was certainly the experience of the author of Ecclesiastes. Those of you who've been coming to all this series of studies will, I'm sure, remember that the teacher, as he styles himself, was a philosopher king of Israel. He set himself the task of understanding the meaning of human existence by a disciplined combination of intellectual reflection, scholarly research, and practical experimentation. He pursued this investigation of his with a thoroughness that would give credit to any doctoral student in the university here in Cambridge. He shirks no difficult problem. He admits no careless logic. He tolerates no wishful thinking. He examines every issue. He tests every hypothesis. He considers every alternative. In short, his work is a model of academic rigor and scientific method. For it's his stated ambition, you see, to leave no stone unturned in the pursuit of his inquiry. He reckons that no successor of his will ever have a better opportunity to conduct such a program of study, so he's determined to make the most of it. I'm going to explore every possible avenue in seeking an answer to this question, he says. Why am I here? What is the purpose of life? I'm going to think and think until I've got to the bottom of it. But that, of course, is where he made his one unproven assumption. He assumed there was a bottom of it to be found. He assumed the riddle of human existence had a solution. But at the end of his exhaustive inquiries, he's forced to the reluctant conclusion that, in fact, it did not. There were just too many unknowns in his philosophical equations. They could not be solved. He confesses his sense of failure at the end of chapter 8, remember. No one can comprehend what goes on under the sun, he says. Despite all his efforts to search it out, man cannot discover its meaning. Even if a wise man claims he knows, he can't really comprehend it. And as a result of this sense of failure, this published thesis of his work, which we call the Book of Ecclesiastes, begins and ends unashamedly on a blunt note of despair. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Everything is meaningless. That's his overture, you remember, in chapter 1, verse 2. And if you look to chapter 12, verse 8, you will find it is also his finale. We don't know why we're here, he says. The purpose of life is an insoluble enigma. As far as you can tell from the evidence, human existence is utterly futile. Meaningless, meaningless, he says. Everything is meaningless. In this respect, as we've said repeatedly in the course of this series of studies, his book has something in common with many works of contemporary 20th century literature. Samuel Beckett's controversial play, Waiting for Godot, for instance. That, too, ends exactly as it begins. With two men vainly looking for something they never find. Two tramps pointlessly waiting for someone who never comes. The message of the play is meaningless. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless. Now, you might anticipate, in the light of such a depressing conclusion, that the teacher's advice to his readers is going to be cynical or even nihilistic. Don't think, you might imagine he's going to say. Don't think. It doesn't pay. I've tried it. The best you can do is just join the lotus eaters of Greek mythology and escape into some fantasy world where the grim realities of existence can't discourage you too much. Hit the bottle. Smoke a joint. If the worst comes to the worst, you can always watch Neighbours. But whatever you do, don't think. Thinking's a sure recipe for despair. Well, the interesting thing is that though you might very well have anticipated that he would offer such counsel, our author, in fact, does not say that at all. Now, it's true, he does recommend an attitude of pragmatic resignation, that is content to enjoy the simple things of life. Again and again, we've heard him saying things like, a man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. He said that, remember, in 2 verse 24, 3 verse 12, 5 verse 18, 8 verse 15, and last week, most poignantly, in chapter 9, verse 9. Enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this meaningless life that God has given you under the sun, all your meaningless days, for this is your lot in life, and in your toilsome labor under the sun. In other words, make the best of it, he says. There is no point in pretending life makes sense, because it doesn't. So take whatever pleasure and satisfaction comes your way in the providence of God, and be grateful for it. But having said that, we would not be doing our author justice if we suggested that he was just advocating a retreat into hedonistic mindlessness. On the contrary, you must think, he says. It's vital to think. Just because thinking can't find the ultimate answer to the meaning of existence, that doesn't mean that thinking is a pointless exercise. No, it's vital to think. Think shrewdly, think responsibly, think maturely, he says. And in these final chapters we're going to look at this morning, he's giving us two fundamental reasons why we must be thinkers like he was. The two reasons are this. First, you must be a thinker because you can't be sure what life will bring. Life is full of uncertainties, he says, and only a thoughtful person is going to stand any chance of negotiating the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune with success. Think because life is uncertain. But more than that, he says, you must think because there is one thing, just one thing, you can be absolutely sure about. One thing there is no question about. One thing you can be absolutely certain of. One day you will die. One day each of us will give account of ourselves to the God who made us. Wisdom it is, says the teacher, to live with that awesome future event always before one's mind. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, he says. Think before you think. By all means do so, for thinking is a dangerous thing to do. Thinking will lead you into some dark and terrifying places if you do it consistently, as the teacher did. But there is one thing that is more dangerous than thinking, he says. And that's refusing to think. Now, says the author, you must think. Think now while you've got the opportunity. Think now while you've got the energy. Think now while you've got the motivation. Think while youth is on your side. For the day will come, he says, when opportunity and energy and motivation and youth will be gone. When that day dawns, all that will be left to you is death and judgment. So think, he says, before it's too late. Well, I want you to join me in studying then this final section of the book of Ecclesiastes. It does have a solemn message, but it's also a salutary message, one for which some of us may be eternally grateful. We'll divide the passage into those two halves I've already indicated. First, think because you can't be sure what life will bring. That covers chapter 9, verse 13, through to chapter 11, verse 6. And secondly, think because there is one thing you can be sure about. And that covers chapter 11, verse 7, through to the end. But we'll start with the theme of uncertainty. Amid all the unpredictable vicissitudes of fortune, only a thinking person, he says, has any chance of being successful. Look at chapter 10, verse 2. One of our author's proverbs, which he likes to string together, as all wisdom authors like to do. The heart of the wise inclines to the right, but the heart of the fool to the left. If you scan through it, you'll see that this whole section is in fact characterized by the contrast between the wise man and the fool. The difference between them, says our author, is fundamentally very simple. The wise man thinks. He thinks about his actions, he thinks about his words. Everything he does is intelligently pondered before it's performed. That's really the force of this rather idiomatic expression, the heart of the wise inclines to the right. To understand that proverb, you have to realize, first of all, that in Hebrew psychology, the heart was the center of thought, rather than of feeling, as it is for us. Furthermore, the right-hand side of the body was associated in the ancient world with the virtues of honor and responsibility and cleverness and skill. We have words in English like adroit and dexterous, coming from the French and the Latin words for right-handedness, that have a similar connotation, though their connection to physical geometry has been lost on us. On the other hand, if you'll excuse that pun, on the left-hand side of the body, Jews associated that with treachery and wickedness and stupidity and clumsiness. Again, we have words like gauche and sinister in our English vocabulary that witness to the universality of this association of ideas. So when our author says, the heart of the wise inclines to the right and the heart of the fool to the left, he's really saying, fundamentally, a wise person is a person that thinks. He thinks with intellectual and moral competence, whereas the fool cannot or will not think at all. Why, he says, you can just tell by the brash and careless way he behaves as he ambles down the street that he's a pompous idiot. 10 verse 3. Even as he walks along the road, the fool lacks sense and shows everyone how stupid he is. No, he says, if there's a glimmer of wisdom in you, you won't aspire to his brand of mindlessness. It may be, as Derek Kidner says, dubious anatomy. But the wise person aims to have a right-handed heart. They aim to be a person who thinks. Thinking brings untold benefits in this uncertain world we live in, says the author. For a start, a thinker is worth battalions in a situation of military conflict. Look at this little story he tells in 9:13. I saw under the sun this example of wisdom that greatly impressed me. There was once a small city with only a few people in it, and a powerful king came against it, surrounded it, and built huge siege works against it. Now there lived in that city a man poor but wise, and he saved the city by his wisdom. There is a famous story told of how Archimedes delivered Syracuse from the Romans. He invented a system of mirrors, it's said, which directed the sun's heat onto the besieging ship's sails, so they caught fire. Some authors think the teacher's alluding to that famous story here. It's not impossible, but I've no doubt there were many less famous incidents to which he could equally well be referring. The point of what he's saying, though, is simple, and he summarizes it in verse 16. Wisdom is better than strength, he says. Brute force and ignorance are no match for the creative imagination of a thinker. Verse 17. Wisdom is better than strength. The quiet words of the wise are more to be heeded than the shouts of a ruler of fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Having said that, though, our author, with his usual rigor, points out there is a downside to his observations also. And that is that, generally speaking, people seem to admire strength more than wisdom, in spite of the fact that it is inferior in utility. Thus, he says, that poor man was not remembered, though he saved the city by his wisdom. The poor man's wisdom was despised, and his words no longer heeded. In fact, he says, summarizing at the end of verse 18, one sinner can destroy a great deal of good. As dead flies give perfume a bad smell, so just a little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. There is a general truth, he says, that if one man can save a situation through his wisdom, it only takes one prat to cause disaster. So it's no good assuming that wisdom will always be rewarded by public recognition or patronage. For all its advantages to society, he says, you may well find, if you're a wise man, that like this poor man, you are ungratefully neglected by citizens with short memories, or perhaps even ignobly demoted by a ruler with an irascible temperament. Look at 10 verse 4. If a ruler's anger rises against you, don't leave your post. Calmness can lay great errors to rest. Here's advice for a man who's got a place at court. If you're lucky enough, he says, to have that position of influence and you're a wise man, don't needlessly risk it by a sulky display just because your boss has got angry with you and blown his top. No, the unruffled response of a wise counsellor can prevent a ruler like that from making the big mistake of replacing him with somebody less competent. No doubt capricious appointments of that kind were all too common in the ancient world, as 10 verse 5 seems to suggest. There is an evil I have seen under the sun, the sort of error that arises from a ruler. Fools are put in many high positions, while the rich occupy the low ones. I've seen slaves on horseback, while princes go on foot like slaves, he says. Now, if you know how volatile political fortune can be, he says, you will not jeopardize your job by going off in a huff. You'll exercise self-control. You'll try to make sure society benefits from your wisdom. In chapter 10, verse 16, just going on a little bit, you'll see he observes another situation there where fools rise to high office. But this time, not because of favoritism on the part of a capricious ruler, but rather because of the ruler's immaturity. Woe to you, O land, whose king was a servant, or I think better translated, a child, and whose princes feast in the morning. In a situation of royal weakness, he says, all too often the court is going to be filled with dissolute young men who spend their time boozing when they ought to be administering the country. And says the teacher, in a kingdom, just as in a household, where there is indolence and self-indulgence of that kind, there's going to also be decay and ruin. Verse 18. If a man is lazy, the rafters sag. If his hands are idle, the house leaks. A feast is made for laughter and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything. In other words, there is no doubt a proper place for festivities, but only when you've gained the financial resources to be able to afford them. The trouble with debauchery at court is it's always accompanied by economic incompetence and therefore financial ruin for the land. Still, he says, though such things are true, it may not be a good idea to shout your mouth off about them too loudly. A wise man at court will realize that sometimes it's more prudent to hold your tongue. Walls have ears. Verse 20, do not revile the king, even in your thoughts, or curse the rich in your bedroom, because a bird of the air may carry your words, and a bird on the wing may report what you say. A little bird told me. The linking theme, then, in this whole section, is that the wise man thinks, in this uncertain world, the wise man thinks where the fool doesn't. He thinks about military strategy, and so he may save the city. He thinks about political diplomacy, and so he saves his job. He thinks about palace informers, and so he saves his neck. There's another thing he thinks about, too. He thinks about the consequences of his actions. Look at verses 8 and 9 of chapter 10. Whoever digs a pit may fall into it. Whoever breaks through a wall may be bitten by a snake. Whoever quarries stones may be injured by them. Whoever splits logs may be endangered by them. The point here is that, as we all know, there are such things as occupational hazards. Every enterprise has them. But the thing about the wise man is, he thinks about what he's doing. He anticipates such possible dangers before they happen, and so he's much less likely to fall victim to them. Such foresight, he says, not only makes him less vulnerable to accidents and misfortune, it can also save him a great deal of unnecessary expenditure of energy. Verse 10. If the axe is dull and its edge unsharpened, more strength is needed, but skill will bring success. In other words, think about what you're doing, and you'll do it with considerably greater efficiency. Of course, it takes more time to sharpen the axe before you start felling the tree, but at the end of the day, you'll do it quicker. Such time spent in careful preparation pays a handsome dividend. In verse 11, he suggests it may even save you hospital bills, too. Verse 11. If a snake bites before it is charmed, there's no profit for the charmer. In other words, a little caution in the early stages of an enterprise may well be the difference between total success and abysmal failure. Look before you leap, as we say. But it is perhaps in the thoughtless words of the fool, which we find an even clearer characteristic of him, more than his impetuous, ill-considered actions. And that's what he goes on to talk about in verse 12. Words from a wise man's mouth are gracious. But a fool is consumed by his own lips. At the beginning his words are folly, at the end they are wicked madness, and the fool multiplies words. It was Abraham Lincoln, I think, who said that he would rather remain silent and be thought a fool
than speak out and remove all doubt. I guess all of us at times have let our tongues run away with us and lived to regret it. But the trouble with the fool is he never seems to learn from experience in this area. He invariably opens his mouth only to put his foot in it. He speaks too hastily, says the teacher, jumping into a conversation when he would do better to listen. He speaks too irresponsibly, uttering mischief and error when what is needed is grace and truth. Or he speaks too much, evacuating his verbal diarrhea when a few well-chosen words are all that are necessary. What's his fundamental problem? I say again, it is that he doesn't think. He doesn't think about the possibility of enemy assault. He doesn't think about political intrigue. He doesn't think about industrial accidents. He doesn't think about verbal indiscretion. He doesn't think about countless other unforeseen calamities that at a stroke can destroy a person's prosperity or even their life. And yet life is full of such unpredictability, as our author observes in verse 14. No one knows what's coming. Who can tell what will happen next? But the fool makes no allowance for this perilous uncertainty. He just blunders on in blissful ignorance. He doesn't think. Indeed, says our author finally, with his tongue very much in his cheek, since he's permanently half asleep, most of the time he can't even remember where he is. Verse 15. A fool's work wearies him. He doesn't know the way to town. Eric Kidner says if you put him on an escalator, he'd get lost. For the wise person, however, these uncertainties of life, far from being something he stupidly ignores, these uncertainties, he says, are the very stuff from which life gains its sense of excitement. That's the thrust of the opening verses of chapter 11. Cast your bread upon the waters, for after many days you will find it again. Give portions to seven, yes to eight, for you do not know what disaster may come upon the land. A story is told of a traveller once in the countryside who came across a farmer leaning on a gate, and being sociable, he thought he would engage the farmer in a little rural conversation. "How is your wheat doing?" he asked him. "Didn't plant none," said the farmer suddenly. "Afraid there weren't going to be no rain." Unabashed, the traveller continued. "Well, how about your potatoes then?" "Didn't plant any of them either. Afraid of the potato blight." "Well," said the traveller, struggling now to think of some other crop he knew about, "what about sugar beet?" "Didn't plant any sugar beet. Afraid of that newfangled rhizomania." "Well," said the traveller, now in exasperation, "what have you planted?"
"Nothing," said the farmer. "I ain't planted nothing. This year I figured I'd just play safe."
Well, it's exactly that kind of overcaution which is in mind in these verses at the beginning of chapter 11. It's possible, says our author, to take the uncertainties of life so seriously you are paralyzed by them. You daren't do anything, just in case some hypothetical catastrophe happens. But that isn't wisdom, he says. That's just another sort of folly. No, the wise person knows there are times when you have to take a gamble. There's no alternative, precisely because life is full of uncertainties. Take a merchant, for example. He sends his corn in ships onto the high seas. He may invest in seven ships or even eight, because he hopes that in the months to come his enterprise will bring a handsome reward. He casts his bread upon the water in the hope that it will return to him. It's a perfectly sensible thing to do. For, says our author, it's no safer, you know, keeping your grain at home. Calamities will befall your barns on the land, just as they can befall your ships at sea. That's the thrust of these verses. Or to come closer to our opening illustration just a minute ago, the farmer, he sows his seed and looks for a harvest. If he has the mentality of the man in our story, he'll plant nothing because he's too busy anxiously looking at the weather prospects. Verse 4, whoever watches the wind will not plant, whoever looks at the clouds will not reap. But that's excessive caution. That way you'll never achieve anything in life. Just because a wise man thinks, it doesn't follow he's incapable of taking risks. They are calculated risks, that's all. Risks that can't be avoided, precisely because in his wisdom he knows he doesn't have all the answers. So verse 5, as you do not know the path of the wind, as you do not know how the body is formed in a mother's womb, as you cannot understand the work of God, the maker of all things, sow your seed in the morning, and at evening don't let your hands stand idle, for you do not know which will succeed, whether this or that, or whether both will do equally well. When the wise merchant or the wise farmer engage in business speculations, then they are still thinking, taking the uncertainties of life seriously. Yes, his ship may sink. Yes, his crops may fail. He knows that. But equally well, they may return to harbour laden or produce a bumper crop. And the path of wisdom, says our author, is not only therefore the path of prudence and of caution. When necessary, the path of wisdom is also the path of adventure, the path of faith. And that drawing into the subject of faith brings us to the second half of the passage. Think because you can't be sure what life will bring. But think even more, says our author, because there is one thing you can be sure about. Back to verses 7 and 8 of chapter 11, which we read earlier. Light is sweet, and it pleases the eyes to see the sun. However many years a man may live, let him enjoy them all. But let him remember the days of darkness, for they will be many. Everything to come is meaningless. How do you feel about getting old? We live in a culture which perhaps more than any other the world has ever known is absolutely paranoid about the aging process, isn't it? Everyone wants to live long, commented Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century, but nobody wants to be old. Oscar Wilde observed that among the high society ladies of his day, 35 seemed to be the most popular age. London, he said, is full of women who by their own choice have remained 35 for years. But these days it's not only the ladies who are obsessed with staying young, is it? Men too invest small fortunes in a desperate effort to remove the wrinkles, conceal the bald patch, colour the grey hair, tone up the flabby tummies. Well, it's not difficult to understand why, is it? Old age brings all kinds of undesirable infirmity. Old age, says one person, is when there's too much room in the house and not enough room in the medicine cabinet. In fact, if you look on to chapter 12 from verse 3 onwards, you'll find a most charming, a most exquisite metaphorical description of the increasing physical decrepitude of old age. Getting old, says our author, is like a dilapidated house which is gradually sinking into ruin. Verse 3, the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men stoop. In other words, your knees shake and your body is bent. The grinders cease because they are few. Old age is when you sink your teeth into a juicy steak and they stay there. Those looking through the windows grow dim. In other words, your vision begins to deteriorate. You become short-sighted or develop cataracts, maybe. And verse 4 is probably an allusion to the increasing isolation which deafness brings. The doors to the street are closed and the sound of grinding fades. Ironically, he says, the little hearing you do retain usually only exacerbates your problem with insomnia. For you rise up at the sound of the birds, the dawn chorus, even though all their songs are fainter than they used to be. In verse 5, he alludes to the phobias and the anxieties that old age brings. Men are afraid of heights and of dangers in the streets, like the old man I know who suffers from vertigo at the top of the stairs, or the old lady who's frightened of muggers, or the traffic. Verse 5 speaks of how the hair, which you manage to retain, tends to go white. The almond tree blossoms. And of how arthritis stiffens the limbs into awkward angularity that makes mobility so difficult. The grasshopper drags himself along. And at the end of verse 5, We're told desire no longer is stirred, which may be a reference to the declining appetite for food, but which is rather more likely, I think, an allusion to the declining appetite for sex. I'm reminded of a rather saucy 70-year-old I met once in a geriatric hospital who told the pretty young nurse, "Every night I put my eyes in the spectacle case, my teeth in the glass, and my ears in the drawer. I'm beginning to worry about what else might have to come off before I can get to sleep." Then comes the final indignity, verse 5. "Then man goes to his eternal home, and mourners go about the streets." I think it was Maurice Chevalier who says, "Old age is not so bad when you consider the alternative." The alternative is death. The silver cord is severed. The golden bowl is broken. The pitcher is shattered at the spring. The wheel is broken at the well, says verse 6. Some suggest these are all further metaphorical descriptions of the failure of vital internal bodily organs, like the heart or the lungs or the brain. But I think it's much more likely they are just rather lovely word pictures of things which are very precious and important, but ultimately fragile, just like a human life. Each of us has immense potential, physical and intellectual potential. We are, as the psalmist says, fearfully and wonderfully made. Yet we are also just dust, a handful of dust. And he says in verse 7, "At the end of the day, the dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit that animated it returns to God who gave it." You see what he means then when he says, yes, life is sweet. It's good to be alive. There is a lot to be said for making the most of the years God gives you. But, he says, beware of the playboy mentality. If life is sweet, remember it is also short. Days of darkness are coming. Days that will render all the years of life that you have enjoyed essentially pointless. As the teacher has told us so many times, so now he tells us once more before he ends. Life lived in the shadow of the grave is futile. Meaningless, he says in verse 8. Meaningless. Everything is meaningless. The moral then? The moral he draws is this. Think. Think while you have the opportunity to think. Think before it's too late. Be happy, young man, while you are young. Let your heart give you joy in the days of your youth. Follow the ways of your heart and whatever your eyes see. But know this, that for all these things, God will bring you to judgment. Your youth and your vigor, he says, are ultimately just one more meaningless thing about human existence. Remember your Creator, then, in the days of your youth. Before those days of trouble come, those days when you will say, I find no more pleasure in living. Most of us here this morning are young. At least, we're not yet ready to put ourselves in the category of the old, which is probably the important thing as far as this passage is concerned. Here's a man of vast intelligence and experience addressing himself very directly to any of us here who count ourselves young. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, he says. Be happy, young man, while you are young, but know that God will bring you to judgment. Maybe it seems morbid to tell young men and women to consider the fact that one day they're going to get old. But the teacher insists it is our willingness to think about the inevitable in that way that distinguishes true wisdom. The problem with the fool is he doesn't think. If he fails to take precautions in view of the uncertainties of life, even more is his folly evident in the fact that he fails to make preparations for the one single certainty in life. One day we shall be old. The greatest sportsman amongst us, The most brilliant scholar, the most saintly Christian? Paul McCartney had his 50th birthday this week, you know. So even baby-faced rock stars get old. No, we should all end our lives in a condition of physical and intellectual dilapidation, unless we die prematurely, that is. And no matter how many beauty treatments we have, no matter how many vitamin pills we take, no matter how many health clubs we subscribe to, that will be our story, because we are mortal creatures. Aging and death are written into our genetic code. They have been since the moment we were conceived. Think then, young man or young woman, before it's too late. Don't let the legitimate enjoyment of your youth, he's saying, blot out from your mind these solemn realities of our human existence. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. This is the advice, remember, of a philosopher who in his day had tried everything there was to try and read everything there was to read. Don't end up, he says, as so many old people end up, desperately trying to recover a relationship with God that has fallen into disrepair as a result of decades of spiritual neglect and complacency. Get yourself in tune with the one who made you now, he said, because it gets harder to do that, not easier as the days go by. It gets harder to repent. It gets harder to change. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, he says. You will if you're wise. Maybe somebody's saying to themselves, oh, I'll turn to God at the 11th hour. I'll have one of those classic deathbed conversions. I'll give myself to God eventually. Of course I will. I want my fire insurance. But I want to sow my wild oats as well. After all, you're only young once. That's the very point, you see. You are only young once. We have only one youth to invest. Would Romeo give wilted roses to Juliet if he could give her fresh? And are you telling me that you will give God the fag end of your life? The years of your final weakness? When you could have given him the years of your early strength? You think God would be pleased on the day of judgment, will reward such a selfish hoarding of the precious gift of youth? No, says Alwolf. Remember your Creator now, while you are young. Pious intentions to remember him later are at the best ungrateful and at the worst downright presumptuous. The Bible does not speak of any tomorrow being ours to play with. It insists we may not even have one. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, he says. For days are coming when youth will be no more, and it may then be too late to think about these things. But just maybe there is somebody here who is troubled by what they see as a sort of inconsistency in what the teacher is saying in these closing chapters of Ecclesiastes. There are a lot of sharp people here. It wouldn't surprise me if you spotted this. I mean, he speaks on the one hand of the meaninglessness of life because we're all going to die. Yet he also speaks on the other hand of the need to get right with God because we're all going to be judged. Well, how do those two things fit together? I mean, for a philosopher who prides himself on logical consistency, this really isn't very coherent. If my final destiny is to moulder in the grave, whatever I do, then what's the point of troubling myself with the thought of judgment? It's not going to make any ultimate difference to my fate, is it? I can understand that objection very well. I suspect the teacher understood it very well, too. For as we've said in each of our previous studies, in all his investigations into the meaning of life, He is laboring with a momentous handicap. He's an Old Testament believer. He lived BC rather than AD. And because of that, there's a vital piece of the jigsaw he's trying to put together missing. It's no wonder it doesn't fit properly. It's no wonder his philosophical problems couldn't be solved. The key to their solution wasn't available to him. Not then. But it is now. Listen again to those words of the Apostle Paul that were read to us earlier in our service. Remember, they came from 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 16. We do not lose heart, he says. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. Our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. Paul, too, you see, is getting old. But we find no geriatric self-pity in Paul. Now, physical infirmity is a nuisance. His body is wearing out, he says. But unlike the teacher of Ecclesiastes, it causes him no despair, no collapse into a sense of meaninglessness. Why does he feel differently about getting old? Why? Because quite literally, old age for the Apostle Paul was not the end of the world. Our citizenship is heaven. In heaven, he would write somewhere else. We eagerly await a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ, who, by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control, will transform our lowly, dying bodies so that they may be like his glorious resurrection bodies. The preacher couldn't say that. He lived in days before God had brought life and immortality to light through the gospel of Jesus. So, though faith's intuition assured him that somehow God had to ultimately distinguish between good and evil, that God had to ultimately judge the world, that people who honored God had to ultimately be rewarded, and that those who ignored him had to ultimately be punished, though he knew there had to be some sort of judgment, as he puts it at the very end of his book, God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing and every, whether it is good or evil, though he knows that intuitively, yet the universality of the grave makes it impossible for him to really reconcile that expectation with the observable evidence. Good or bad, we all die. That's why he's reduced to his depressing conclusion, you see. Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. No, it isn't, says Paul. Here's the missing piece of the jigsaw. Everything would be meaningless. Nothing would fit. In a sense, nothing did fit before Jesus burst in upon the scene. But now, by his resurrection from the dead and his enthronement in heaven, the whole picture has been transformed. Sure, my body is gradually wearing out, says Paul. Sure, one day death, like some unsympathetic landlord, is going to order me to vacate the property. But I'm not going to be rendered some homeless refugee by such an eviction order. No, he says, I have a better house. A permanent home, an eternal home in glory, waiting for me even now. A home not in the grave, but in the eternal kingdom of Jesus Christ. Why, says Paul, I can't wait to get there. Death for me has been transformed from some forbidding pit of meaninglessness into a hope, into something I eagerly anticipate, something I want to experience. I would rather, he says, be away from the body so that I can be at home with the Lord. And that's why the teacher, even though he cannot with complete logical coherence defend it, that's why the teacher is right to exhort you and me this morning to remember our Creator. There is a heaven to gain, and there is a hell to shun. God will bring every deed into judgment, including every hidden thing, whether it is good or evil. Be happy, young man, while you're young. But know that for all these things, God will bring you to judgment. It's true, he says. I know that we can't see that day of judgment yet. Eternal things are still invisible to us as they were to the teacher. But for us, this hope of the day of judgment is no longer vague, wishful thinking. For us, God has given assurance to everybody of his intention to judge the world, and he's done it by raising Jesus Christ from the dead. We shall stand, says Paul, before the judgment seat of Christ. An awesome prospect, of course it is. Who could not be daunted by such a thought? But you see, also, it is the only prospect that can deliver us from the futility of life. If we but understood it, the day of judgment is a glorious thing because it means right and wrong matter. It means that life can have a purpose. It means that we don't end 6 foot under in meaninglessness. Christ is risen from the dead. We have the empty tomb and dozens of witnesses on our side to confirm it. And because he's risen, and only because he's risen, you see, those of you here who are bereaved, you don't have to mourn without hope. And those of you here who are old, you don't have to die without peace. And those of us here who are young don't have to live without purpose. Think then. Think while you have time to think. Think while you have energy to think. Think while you have the motivation to think. Think before it's too late. Let's pray together. As we pray, you might like to think about a poem that's inscribed on a clock in Chester Cathedral. When, as a child, I laughed and wept, time crept. When, as a youth, I dreamt and talked, time walked. When I became a full-grown man, time ran. Later, as I older grew, time flew. Soon I shall find, while traveling on, time gone. Will Christ have saved my soul by then?